In our time together, Lord, we ask to better comprehend that we can't earn your love. Help us to realize that you don't love us because we are worthwhile, but that we are worthwhile because you love us. In Jesus' name, amen. I think we can see all right this way. The topic is boosting a bruised self-worth. I'd like to make a couple of definitions first so we are thinking about the same thing. I'll use the term major caregivers, and by that often I mean parents, but sometimes children are not raised by their parents. And more children today are really, many are being raised by maybe babysitters, nursery school employees and such as that. And of course a teacher might also be a major caregiver to a child. I'll also use the term stowaway. Probably the best description of that might be that a friend of mine was at a conference where I was at Gonzaga University many years ago. He was an associate dean of a medical school. I hadn't met Bob before, but we got in a small group together, and Bob kind of took over the small group. And maybe sometimes that's something we object to, but I was getting a little resentful, you know, well, what do you think? And Ken, what do you think about this? And you know, I kind of felt, well, I'll tell him when I want to say something. And he was really in control of the situation. The second day, we were in a couple of larger groups, and Bob made a proposal for his group, and the leader said, well, what do the rest of you think about it? And they kind of voted him down. And the leader was pretty astute and said, how do you feel about that, Bob? Oh, it's all right, you know, no problem, it's all right. And he said, well, that's kind of strange. Usually if people don't agree with us, it kind of hurts. And here this associate dean of a medical school broke down and cried in front of the whole group. Of course, that would be tough for me because I was raised also, you know, boys don't cry. And I was his friend at that point. I went over and put my arm around him and said, Bob, I understand how you feel. And then he said, by way of explanation, he said, you know, always I've had this little boy inside, or kind of, he said kind of behind me, you know, and I try to keep him hidden back here. And so no one else will know about my little boy. And I call that now a stowaway. Some people call it a minikin. But my little boy from childhood days hasn't died. Still inside me. I may try to stuff him down, keep him quiet. Some people, I can tell by your faces, you know what I'm talking about. And but he rises to the occasion many times, and what he experienced is still alive within me. So that's what I kind of call a stowaway. Our major caregivers that I mentioned a minute ago really are basic in developing our level of self-worth throughout our life. If one of us has been somewhat mistreated as a child, one place or another, we have accepted that as kind of an infallible judgment. These are kind of like godlike people, you know, parents and teachers, and we don't question. We don't stop to say they are very ineffective in their teaching or their parenting. Something must be wrong with me, is normally the response that we give. So we have three parts tonight to what we're going to be doing. The first, I'd like for us to do some sharing on what types of on caring actions of major caregivers that have been most helpful to develop a positive sense of self-worth. Now, many people use the term self-esteem today, and that's perfectly all right if you wish to use it. I prefer self-worth because self-esteem has second definitions of conceit, pride, and vanity, and therefore I kind of prefer self-worth, but you can use either one. Second, we'll want to share with others some of our experiences, actions of major caregivers that bruised self-worth when we were younger. No need to identify, you know, this was mother or father or aunt or uncle. We don't care. Whether you saw it at home or in a neighbor or your friend's home, that's perfectly all right. And then third, we will discuss a little bit about what helps can we share with each other to kind of get rid of, overcome that deficient feeling that a stowaway may have within us. And I have a handout. You are more people than I thought, but maybe every other person can have a handout, or maybe I can get some more run tomorrow and set them out for you if you don't get one this evening. Handout that will help us somewhat with understanding how we might overcome some of the bruised feelings that may be ours. Any questions so far? Okay, first, can you think back? Examples you may have seen, you know, at school, with others or yourself, at home, or some other major caregiver that nurtured you and cared for you and made you feel you really were worthwhile, a worthwhile member of the family at home. Positive self-worth. Anybody start? Yes, thank you. What?
Lots of hugs.
Lots of hugs, thank you. We ought to pass one of these back to her. I have a few up here. Have you seen these? Yeah, free hug coupon. She doesn't need it. Okay, you can have it. All right, fair enough. What else, Matt, gave you a feeling of good self-worth?
Good touch.
Good touch. Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. And it's still important, isn't it? Right. I don't know if it's more important just for the two extremes of ages or not. But I know it's very important for children. And from what I've seen, when you go to a hospital or a nursing home, how important it is there too. Okay, what else?
Listening.
Hallelujah. Yeah, that is so important. When we don't listen, what are we really doing to somebody?
Saying
they're unimportant, making them invisible. Yeah, you don't even exist. Right. Okay, what else have you found that's boosted self-worth? Yes?
Being asked to do something responsible.
Yeah. In a sense, you're also saying, well, I'm trusting somebody. Yeah. As opposed to a temptation many times, oh, let me do this. You know, taking it out of their hands, and they don't have a chance to do things well. Yes?
Praise.
What was it someone said? If you had $5 for everything you said good about somebody and had to pay 10 cents for everything negative, you know, would you be ahead or behind in life? Yeah.
Back here again.
Yes.
Just taking time to be with the person, just being there.
Very good, Pat. Yeah. Being there, and this applies also when there is, someone might be ill or grieving or sad about something, and many of us, I think, say, well, I won't go over because I don't know what to say. And what Pat is saying is so important, just being there. A good friend of ours at church, kind of a patron saint in church, Irv, died. And it happened that three of us who knew about it just went over to the house shortly thereafter. And we sat at a table, and Gertrude served us coffee, and she entered into some of it and all that, but we sat and talked with ourselves also. And many times she's mentioned that, you know, you were there. We didn't have to talk just to her. Yes?
Having the caregivers tell you, actually say that they love you.
Yeah. That's having caregivers say they love you. I don't remember my dad ever saying he loved me. And there are articles I've read from others, you know, from women too. Just, I never, you know. And then, this is a worse admission, I guess. Because of that type of a background, I don't know that I very often said to my children, I love you. And I have Merle Olson, a good friend of mine at West, and he'd just tell his kids, you know, how he loved them and how much he thought of them. And I'll throw one in there too, because it relates to this. And he asked their forgiveness when he did something wrong.
I wanted to say, I think it's really nice. A lot of parents really tell their kids how much they love them. But I think if you knew that your parents loved you and they didn't tell you, I think that's pretty important.
Yes, that's right. If all the actions...
If you just knew
if you're convinced.
Important if they didn't tell you, as we would think.
But I've heard them say, but if, you know, like I would say, you know, he really loves you, and they'd say, but if you would just tell me,
I think it's icing on the cake, if nothing else.
Yeah.
We have three hands here. Yes?
Not comparing me to others.
Oh, yes.
Special.
Yes. Treating you just as you are and accepting you as you are. Right. We'll touch that later. Someone over here and then you. Yes.
My point was a continuation of what I love you. I have a very dear friend that she tells me that her husband says several times a day to her, I love you, but his actions never show it. And she says, I tell him that, but he says, oh, well, I was upset. So I think that there has to be that action that follows the I love you to prove it, not necessarily prove it, but to show that you really mean what you're saying.
Nonverbals are louder than verbals.
Yes.
And just before you have that, may I make one comment about this? The fellow, let me see, the wife said, hey, husband never told her he loved her. And they've been married 30 years maybe. And she finally said, hey, you know, could you tell me you love me? Look, he said, when we got married, I told you I loved you. If anything ever changes, you'll be the first to know.
Along with her comment, as caretakers, especially towards children and maybe others, but just making sure the basic needs are covered. Food,
yes.
Clothing, place to live.
Mm-hmm. That's nonverbal again,
that's
right?
I think affirmation is an important one too. I don't think I was good at that when I was parenting. If they said, "I hate my sister," I'd say, "Oh no, you can't hurt your sister. You know, you love your sister." Well, at that particular point, they hated their sister, and I didn't give them permission to have that feeling.
Yeah, kiss your sister and make up. I heard that.
Yeah, oh, you do too.
Yeah. When you least feel like it. Yeah, yes.
Discipline when used correctly.
It's strange that I agree with you. I remember our son. After, when he needed discipline, and we did it, he was, what would you say?
Boys, they were so good for several days. I just did everything I wanted them.
But they kind of seemed happy. But they seemed happier. They seemed happier, I think.
Well, but they were worth your risking that.
Yeah. Right.
Appreciate it.
Well, let me throw a few others that maybe you've had these. I'm not sure. Yeah, letting your children know that they are, and others. This is not just children, but we're talking about them. Their love for who they are and not for what they do. Because if there are preconditions, and it's so easy, you know, well, if you get good grades, then you're a good kid. Or if you mow the lawn well and don't leave any, you know, things sticking up somewhere, then you're a good kid. And then you have to earn it. And that, what if we had to do that with God? You know, we're all losers in that situation. And then I did kind of hint a little bit about forgiving others, but being big enough to ask for forgiveness. I think I would have had a completely different attitude. You know, parents make mistakes. But if after some things that had gone really wrong and sour, if my dad, for example, had said, you know, well, I really lost my temper. I really lost my temper. I didn't mean to wail into you that hard. I could have understood that. It would have been a lesson to me also in forgiveness and giving forgiveness too. Another thing about self-worth, was your hand up? Oh, another thing about self-worth is what I call jettisoning the grudge luggage. That's really not forgiving in a sense, holding a grudge. I've talked to one young man here at Holden this last week who still had a heavy grudge against some people in the world. And I said, you know, they don't know anything about this. You're suffering, but it doesn't bother them one bit. If you can't forgive them, you know, you're the one that is suffering. Then you mentioned someone affirming people. Have you done much affirming by letter? One of my practices last number of years on the 1st of November is to try to write a letter of appreciation, thanks, whatever it is, to others, but one a day for the first 10 days, and then mail them so they'll arrive about Thanksgiving time. You'd be surprised at some of the comments that come back as a result of that. And then let me just think, you know, we tend to do as we were done by. But think in terms, if I sent out just 5 of those, and think if those 5 did the same thing the next year, and that happened again, this is hypothetical. In 3 years, 525 people would receive such letters. In 6 years, 15,600. In 9 years, 1,953,125. You know, how far into the future can your actions of affirming someone else go? You know, if a few people catch on, and it goes on down through the next century and 2100 and so on, like that. We also had Appreciation Sunday at church one time, between services, coffee, cookies, and then paper and stamps and envelopes and all, to write notes of appreciation to people who have done things in church for years and nobody has ever said boo, probably. And one lady who had baked communion bread for about 15 years or something, we saw that she got several letters of appreciation because we'd heard that she thought nobody ever knew she'd done anything. And she walked out on air, you know, after that. Igniter phrases. I don't know if I've got a few right here that I can, like, you know, I have faith in you. That's a great idea. See, you can do it. We can depend on you. You're doing beautifully. I know you'll make it work. That's quite an improvement for someone who isn't perfect but has made an improvement. You had touching and hugging. We are in a high-tech, low-touch society. And one little example of that, I think, now, there was a study made of how many times people in restaurants touch each other. London, 0. That's in a 1 hour meal, see. Gainesville, Florida, 2. Paris, 110. San Juan, Puerto Rico, up to 180. Jesus regularly reached out and touched children, and touched other people. The Holden hug, is that still quite a popular thing here? I know years ago you get off the bus, you couldn't make it to the steps before you had some hugs. And when the buses left, it was the same way. Yes? H-E-R-D-E-R.
No, I think it's F. I don't know.
Oh, further.
Like four.
Like
four.
Like,
I don't know where it came from.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. And no matter how many people, you all get in one big...
Maybe we could do a herder here.
If you stay till the end, we'll give you a herder.
We have to count to see what number it would be.
We'd have the world's record in the Guinness book for that. Yeah, that's good. Oh, it's on your, oh, she's got a button, hug for the health of it. And oh, wonderful. Hug. Hug for the health of it.
Our pastor has a hugging apron. When he goes out on the last hymn, he takes his stole off and he puts his hugging apron on and hugs everybody as they come out.
The pastor hugs everybody. That's great. Well, you know, I candidly, when I was, for many, many years, I didn't hug people. You know why? You know why, don't you? What? Well, yeah, and I was afraid they'd misunderstand me, see? And now we have some people in church that they, I've got to have my hug every Sunday. And it's kind of nice, you know, to be able to give a person like that a hug. And then there's some who are less comfortable with it. But I've always found an arm around the shoulder they don't object to. But a little stiff, you know, but they don't, I think it's good for them. Well, hugs are great. Well, and of course, I don't have time for it, but Leo Bustead, as you know, and all his animals and how you can hug animals and how animals love you and you touch animals and they climb all over you and such as this. As he says in one of his articles, if wife comes home 2 hours late, everybody's upset. If the whole family comes home 5 hours late, the dog still loves you and jumps around and accepts you and all that. Let's see, anything else? Oh, well, yes, as parents and others. I've got a friend, one of our former students. He was a principal in Alaska, Kenai. And he asked the teachers, try to catch your kids doing something right. You know, the natural thing is you catch them doing something wrong. And when a substitute came to a classroom, one of the assignments of the substitute was to give the principal the name of the student that helped him or her the most. And then Dick would call a parent at home and say, you know, your child did such and such and helped. Well, what were those kids in the classroom trying to do when there were substitutes after that? You know, get someone to call home. I don't know how true it is, but I heard it was true that a principal called a home in a case like that and started to say, Bill did a real good job today, Ann, and the mother cut in and said, you've got the wrong number. And they checked back and forth and then found out it was her son, and she broke down and cried and said, nobody has ever called us from school unless there's a problem. That can happen in homes too. Same type of thing. Well, I guess one other thing that fits maybe the church situation. I think we can help people of all ages with self-worth if we provide opportunities for them to serve those in need. And it's probably particularly pertinent here when we have many elderly after Labor Day attending here. I think that the church is losing millions of hours of volunteer help by not trying to organize and help people to serve others. We were in Washington, D.C. in June, and there's a Church of Our Savior. Anybody heard about that one? They have about 7 units, various places in one church. Their major goal was first to find out what gifts people have when you join, and then put them to work. And they changed a little bit. Now they find out what the needs are, and they say, hey, you probably got gifts in some areas you don't know about. Here's a need, will you try it? But they try to put everybody into work that boosts them, you might say, because they feel good about helping others. Anything else before we move to part two? Let's see, I might have one thing else that I didn't comment on here. No? Well, yes, one. A lady in a nursing home discussion group choked with emotion. I was talking to some of them. when telling about her childhood. She had always wanted to crawl up and snuggle down in her mother's lap for that delightfully secure feeling. But she never enjoyed that cherished haven. Her mother always rebuffed her by saying, "No, I can't hold you in my lap. You hurt my knees." And someone can get branded with a lifelong feeling of, you know, I'm not okay at a point like that. Okay, let us take a look at what examples of particularly hurtful or bruising acts to a person's self-worth on a child or youth by major caregivers of any type.
Touching.
Bad touching, okay, yeah.
And you know, that whole gamut.
Whole gamut of leading to sexual abuse. Right, right. Yeah, yes.
I was told that I couldn't sing a duet when I was about in second grade for a Sunday school. And I still don't. I'm not embarrassed about singing.
Yeah. Those things carry over, don't they?
I think some of my son too. You're not too embarrassed.
Yeah, she was told second grade that she couldn't sing a song in Sunday school, and that, well, that little child, stowaway, is still in you saying, "I can't sing." It's about what it is. Yes?
Just put downs.
Put downs of?
Criticism.
Yeah. So easy to be critical. Yes?
Well, extension of that, the verbal abuse.
Yeah. What kind of verbal, can any specific examples of what you're thinking of?
I'll say you're stupid or dumb or wish you'd never been born.
That is a crucially devastating one. I wish you'd never been. What can I do about that?
Die.
Die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, what else? Yes.
Or being compared. My mother would compare. I mean, I can remember, and she will, now she'll say she never said it, but she said, "When I was your age, I was certainly dating by then."
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, at that age, as a teenager.
Let's stick with comparing just for a minute, and then you can bring up other things. One thing we do is to ask, we compare child A with child B. My sister got all top grades. She's older than I am. Guess what? You know, what's the matter with you? You know, and or maybe one child is very athletic, and the other child may not be. It's almost as unfair as saying, "How come you don't have brown eyes?" You know, to one of your children. What can they do, you know, about that? I've got something here that deals, let me see, yeah. And I kidded at first, you know, front row A's, second row B's and such as that. But our schools, and I've been in schoolwork much of my life, unfortunately do a lot of grading. And I share this, that the Department of Agriculture, you know, it grades beef, prime, choice, good, commercial, utility, and canner. And schools aren't much more creative, although they use other labels. And of course, schools must give some method of reporting a child's progress. But my heart has ached many times when a large number of children are relegated to the commercial, utility, or canner categories. We've got to recognize that there are other gifts than book learning, or beauty, or athletic prowess. You know, it's going to happen again that a student with low grades will turn out to be an Albert Einstein, because that's the way he went through school, with low grades. Or a student with low grades in English will later become someone like Winston Churchill. Children are extremely sensitive about being classified as inept failures. A story is told of a boy in school who vigorously resisted getting on the scales to determine his weight. He feared that when the results were released, he would again be labeled below average. All children need assurance that their value as a beloved child of God has nothing to do with the measurements given them in any one single area. Every child excels in some area. And we also grade schools. You know, you've seen headlines in newspapers. I saw it in San Francisco once. San Francisco schools below average school. I was a principal of one school in Portland where if we had, eight national merit semifinalists, we were doing real well for that community. I was principal in another school once where we'd have 25 national merit semifinalists, you know. Well, the teachers weren't working any harder or better in one school than another. Children differ. Then there's also a comparison we have of ourselves. This, I think, is where we get a lot of low self-worth. Always you can find somebody who will excel in any area, probably, unless you are the world's best. You know, unless each of us is the world's best. Always, you know, so I do a little writing. There are others who write better. Singing, even if you did sing, there'll be someone who sings better. And we compare ourselves with the best. And that's not fair. God made you and I uniquely. There's no one else like us. Studies have shown no one in the world has the same finger and handprints as you or the same footprints. Can you imagine that? Of all the people in the world? And how many people have you seen that are just look just like you? You are unique. And we should appreciate that. One other thing here on the area of what can happen to kids. If I can find that. A 17-year-old high school student threw a $20,000 tantrum in his home. In the outburst, Brad destroyed furniture, smashed lamps, mirrors, appliances with a baseball bat. Then he fired his father's rifle, breaking nearly every window. Brad had just been dropped from the school basketball team. He knew his family would feel let down. Two older brothers had been high school basketball stars and each won a college athletic scholarship. The family's expectation that Brad would equal his brother's exploits was an unrealistic and unfair burden. Okay, that was comparing. What else do you think of? That puts us down.
Overprotectiveness.
Overprotectiveness. What does that say to us?
You're not able to do something.
Yeah. You can't handle it. We'll have
and
to do it.
And there's the opposite, too, of requiring a child to do something that he feels totally unable to do.
Yeah. Unrealistic expectations. Mm-hmm. That's right. Both of them.
He's in trouble if he doesn't do it, and he's in trouble if he does it and can't quite.
Yeah. On unrealistic expectations, there's one that they can lead to real problems. So let me share one with you. This was in, the Lutheran Women. Bonnie Ursery reviewed a story of her daughter's attempted suicide. Yulita, 29, college graduate, promoted to department head of a major company, was also planning to marry. From all outward appearances, Yulita had everything a young woman could want. Yet her apologetic suicide note ended with, quote, only death will suffice to extinguish the pain. Though Yulita had stopped breathing, she was rushed to a hospital and subsequently revived. Later, she revealed to her mother she'd been considering killing herself since she was a little girl. You can't mean that, her mother gasped. You're the most successful young person I know. You're number one in everything you do. I've always been proud of you. Yulita responded, that was the only reason I was number one. So you'd be proud of me, accept me, and love me. I knew that if I ever failed, then... She glanced away and cried. Looking back, her mother understood that their central family message had been, succeed. Compete, I'd told her. Earn your self-worth, in other words. Yolita's mother had studied the works of many child psychologists to learn more about motivation, but not one mentioned that love should be independent of success or failure, that it should be free and unconditional as a gift rather than something to be earned. Just that ignores the Christian message. It ignores God's unconditional love. Consequently, Yolita had considered her mother's love simply as an earned reward for fine performances. Unrealistic expectations. Yeah. What else can hurt our self-worth? What about teasing? Ever bothered you?
It's cruel.
It's cruel. Oh, one personal example. I didn't walk till I was 18 months. There were some reasons for it that were probably psychological. And when I did, when they finally got me to walk, what they did, I'd have to hold on to something as I'm walking. They finally got me to hold on to my rompers or whatever. See, and then that was not the worst, but it seemed to be the major humorous family story when friends and relatives gathered. And time and again, you see, I would hear that, and I'd feel, what's wrong with me? Something's got to be wrong with me that happened. So, teasing can be, as you say, it can be cruel. What about nicknames? Well, there are all kinds of nicknames, Why don't you just spin off and throw out some nicknames? What have you heard?
Meatball.
Moose.
What?
Moose.
Okay.
Four eyes.
It
used to be.
Thank you. Thank you for that. As someone has said, there is no defense against a nickname. Well, you see, I think you'll notice one thing. The negative nicknames come out faster, and they usually get some laughter. And the positive nicknames are harder to think of. I've done this before, and the list may be, well, I'll just pick figures, it may be 25 negative and 5 positive or something like that. And then some of the positives have kind of a negative twist depending on what you think of them, such as that too. But anyway, those nicknames and teasing can hurt. What else have you, anything else in mind that you've seen other people might be actions that hurt their self-worth, their sense of self-worth? Or in your own case, either one?
I think when you have a chemically dependent parent, you question your self-worth.
Yeah.
Because of what they're doing to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you have?
No.
Oh, just a fly.
Just a fly.
that is related somewhat, but not directly, to another issue, and that's where your parents have some problems, and where divorce enters the family too. We know today that divorce affects 1 million children a year. And usually, as parents, the parents are so actively involved and concerned that the attention the children get might be less than before, and maybe wasn't a whale of a lot before, because it's kind of survival skills for the parents that remain. One aside from this, too, when I was writing a small book on what's helpful and unhelpful when visiting sick, bereaved, divorced, and imprisoned. I talked to people who were recently divorced, And one in our church had been very, very active. And I said to her one Sunday after church was over, I said, well, Nancy, I'll call her. Nancy, I said, I know you're divorced, but I don't know what to say now. And it just like I opened the door to, you know, a lot of water piled up behind there. She said, no one ever talks to me about this. And then there was someone up here at Holden Village about that time too, and I talked to her about it. And she said, when I'm with another group, and everyone knows I've just been divorced, but she said it's like a white elephant is sitting in the room, and everybody sees it, but nobody mentions it. So the first person just wanted to talk and talk and talk, and we did. I mean, it was not something that needed to be hidden, but we are the uncomfortable ones usually when we're contacting someone else. And then as far as the children are concerned, often their feelings are not considered. Or maybe they're kept in the dark, and they know there's some rumblings going on, but they aren't sure exactly what's going to happen. And one of the worst things that some children have said is, I may be living with mother, and I go to visit dad, and we're out, and we're having dinner together, and then he looks at me, and they aren't getting along well, the parents, and he says, you remind me quite a bit of mother. Or mother, maybe the mother might say sometime, you know, and maybe a little exasperated, well, you remind me of dad. What, you know, what can the child do? They need to be themselves, yes.
I had the experience when my husband died of two different lady friends being resentful that my husband had died and they were divorced. They said, you got all the hot dishes, the hot rolls, the hugs. You got all this. When we got divorced, our friends all left us because they didn't want to take sides.
Yes, there is that problem. There is that problem.
I have found this so much. The resentment that there is of a divorced person towards, because everybody and people, it's 5 years since my husband died, and people are still, of course, if someone comes along with a hug, I'm not going to bypass it.
Yeah.
But they said when we got divorced, one person came and hugged us.
Well, I would be a little more scared to hug someone who, a woman just been divorced, lest she think, you know, in my mind, she might think I'm trying to take advances.
Right. Yeah.
It may be silly, but that's me, see?
No, I understood what these people were trying to tell me. I was angry. Oh boy, I'm really lucky my husband died, you know. I mean, I just, but then when I realized, you know, now I make a point of when I know someone is divorced, making them talk about it.
Yeah, allowing them, sure, to talk about it, yeah.
And just keep on until, and what, maybe they're going to sit and cry.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's the first one they've been able to cry to.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this one of these ladies that I mentioned too said to me, who had been divorced, she said, divorce is a death that never quits. You live with it, and it's, yeah, it's still there. It's not finished, I guess.
Right.
In some ways.
That's, I really have empathy for people that have gone. I have children that have gone through divorce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no matter how much they put their life back together and go on, somewhere along the line, that rock gets in the path again.
Yeah.
Little children, they'd say, families of divorce often feel that it's their own fault. And so that's another kind of abuse. If you don't get through to them, to have them really know that it isn't.
Tell them that it is not their fault,
really
yeah.
Have them know that it's not.
If I'd only done the dishes problem. All the time, or if there wouldn't be so much trouble in the family, or such as that, yeah. That's very. Loving them and letting them be known they are loved unconditionally. That's maybe the underlying word in this whole thing this evening, is unconditional love. Let's see if there is anything else that I wanted to hit. Well, okay, if we feel that we must earn our self-worth, and I felt that for a long time, What does that make me do as far as my work is concerned, generally? Competitive, right?
Perfectionistic.
Right. Perfectionist, workaholic, and I'm indispensable. Work so hard, I'm indispensable. Because I've got to be loved, liked, or, you know, important somewhere. On this indispensability, short poem, sometime when you're feeling important, sometime when your ego's in bloom, sometime when you take it for granted you're the only important one in the room, sometime when you think that you're leaving would fill and leave, that you're going would leave an unfillable hole, follow these simple directions and see how it humbles your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water, put your hand in it up to the wrist, take it out, and the hole that's remaining is the measure of how you'll be missed. Splash all you wish as you enter, stir up the water galore, but stop, and in just a minute it looks much the same as before. But hard-working people who have to earn their self-worth are often perfectionists, often are workaholics. And I know because I see one when I shave in the morning, or I did for quite a while anyway. Okay, we better move to the last part, which has to do with boosting self-worth. And here is a challenge, and you look like you can handle a challenge. See if you can, there are about 16 or so of those there, see if you can, every other one or something like that. This has to do with what helpful information can be shared with those who have some type of a deficiency in self-worth, who have, and stowaway still in them that doesn't feel too worthwhile. And I'll kind of run through some of these because we're going to quit in time for services. First one, God loves and accepts the real me just as I am. The unique me as he made me, I've added there. Not the individual I'm struggling and failing to become. Forget about every other one. I'll run off a few more tomorrow and maybe put them on the counter.
You can run something off here?
Well, it's over in the main office.
Really?
Yeah. And then B, God doesn't consider those he created in his image to be worthless. Once that I accept that I am God's unique creation, unique again, I perceive myself in a whole new light. Convinced that I am unconditionally accepted by God's love, I can experience an undeniable sense of self-worth. There is no yardstick that God has for us. There is no certain amount that we have to earn or prove in order to be completely accepted by him. See, when I impose stiffer conditions on myself than God does, I dismiss his grace and peace that he has provided for me at such a great cost. You know, when I say, hey, I'm not good, God, I'm not good enough and all that, you know, I'm not lovable, I'm really dismissing his grace. Hard to understand how it can be so gracious, but it's there. D, individuals with a low sense of self-worth may be helped by involving them in programs of assistance to those less fortunate. I think there's a big gap for the church to fill here. God has ordained that many of our most self-enhancing, you know, self-worth-boosting activities will involve serving the humble, the handicapped, and the powerless. Start in nursing homes, any place, the homeless. E, each one should examine his own conduct for himself. This is Paul's writing to the Galatians. Then he can measure his achievement by comparing himself with himself and not with anyone else. And how often I compare myself with others and you may compare yourself with others. And Paul says, you know, compare yourself with yourself, not with somebody else. And F, my self-worth is a gift from God that does not depend on what I can do to earn it, I would add, by myself. It relies on what God can do in and through me when I'm willing, when I answer his call, when I say, what is it you've got for me to do? And even though I feel inadequate, and I've been given some responsibilities, you know, I thought, why me? You know, I'm not able to go back and talk to all these people back at such and such a place. But God says, you know, in your weakness is my strength. Let's see. G, recognize the power for good that God has placed in your two hands. And you commented on this. Reach out in love as Jesus did. Touch and hold hands. Hold hands with those who are physically, emotionally, and spiritually distressed or needy. I've only had one experience really in the hospital. And that's a lonely place. And lots of people run around. And if someone comes in and, sit down next to you and hold your hand and look at you rather than stand at the head of the bed and talk at you. All the difference in the world. I'm sure you know that. H, studies reveal that when I nurture, feed, and protect. Leo, are you here?
Yes.
I thought he might be asleep. I didn't want him to miss his. Nurture, feed, and protect an animal companion. I also am nourished as I experience my pet's unconditional love. We have so much to learn from animals. That wasn't very fair, Leo, but we did talk about that earlier, too. I want you to know that. And
I checked on
you. Yeah. God does not love me because I am worthwhile. I am worthwhile because God loves me today. And he will continue to love me on each of my tomorrows. And Jay, if I will only pause, contemplate, and accept the full meaning of my baptism, my search for a genuine sense of self-worth will end. We forget that, don't we? Okay, God knows us better than we know ourselves, and he loves us better too. And let's see, L. God, help me to convince my neighbor of your unconditional love and acceptance by my unconditional love and acceptance of my neighbor. That's a powerful one because every person is your neighbor. And last, God sees each one of us as we can be, but he still loves every one of us as we are. And this is good news. Any last minute comment? Or if not, I think it's that time, and I appreciate your good attention. You are really a group of well-bred people.